Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Hello, and welcome to What Goes Up, a Bloomberg weekly markets podcast. I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor on the markets team at Bloomberg.
And I'm Emily Barrett, a markets reporter filling in for Sarah Ponczak this week, who is on vacation.
And this week on the show, we'll talk about how soothing words from the Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell sent the S&P 500 above 3,000 for the first time. And this record comes despite a rather dismal outlook for corporate earnings. Does profit growth even matter when the Fed sounds like it's ready to cut rates? Also, remember the Winklevoss twins, the Bitcoin billionaires and famous nemeses of Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg? We'll catch up with what they've been up to with a reporter who spent some time with them this week.
And don't worry, even though Sarah's off, we'll continue the tradition of exchanging the craziest things we saw in markets.
Of course, we would not give up that tradition, regardless of vacation schedules. Well, we've got some great guests here to walk us through the markets this week, Emily. But I need to ask, you grew up in Australia. Did anyone listen to Bruce Springsteen in Australia, or was he considered like the poor man's Men at Work down there?
Well, you know, between that and what was it, Midnight Oil, that was really where we focused. But Bruce Springsteen, he had a little name recognition,
a little niche following.
Yeah, okay. Definitely.
Well, I've got one of his classics, Kitty's Back, the song Kitty's Back in my head. But instead of Kitty, I keep hearing the name Tina, Tina's Back. And that's because of that famous acronym. You know, if you're a stock market pundit, you really need to coin an acronym to make a name for yourself. And Tina, of course, is There Is No Alternative, which I feel like is back this week with all this focus on the Federal Reserve and this hypothetical interest rate cut we'll get. So hopefully our guests here can shed some light on that. Joining the show, first off, Bloomberg columnist, former big honcho at the Financial Times, I think London and England's biggest Red Sox fan there is. Is that right? John Authors, welcome
possibly,
to the show.
Possibly. Thank you very much. I thought Tina was went back to Margaret Thatcher. She ran, ran my home country throughout my entire youth.
Okay. Anyway, Tina is in the eye of the beholder, though?
Something John, like that.
John, the Red Sox just played the first baseball game, MLB game in London. There were like 30-some runs scored. What happened there?
Was per it the, game.
Per
yes.
game. Was, yeah. it, was that the metrics system of scoring runs in London? What?
Well, my best theory, obviously it wasn't a huge ground, although the dimensions weren't particularly weird. There was a big foul territory, which you would have thought would have diminished runs. It would have been easier to catch foul pop-ups. My best guess is that the organizers followed their instructions a little too scrupulously, with the result that the area blacked up behind the pitcher's arm was bigger and blacker than it is in the average MLB stadium, with the result that the hitters really could see the ball much more clearly than they were accustomed to. That's my best guess. It certainly looked much more prominent and blacker, as far as I could see, than it normally does in a major league park.
That's a great theory. I buy it completely. And John's analysis,
thank you.
John's market analysis is even better than his baseball analysis. So we'll get to that soon. But also joining the show is another reporter from our markets team, Vildana Heirich. She covers all sorts of things, stocks, a lot of Bitcoin. She's our reporter who talked to the Winklevoss twins this week. And she's also done a lot of reporting on the outlook for earnings. So Vildana, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, absolutely. Great to have you. Now, John, let's start with you. Obviously, the entire equity market's fixation has returned to the Federal Reserve, this notion that we're going to get an interest rate cut.
Yes.
And you had an interesting column out recently and basically discussing the way you can't really look at equity valuations in isolation. You all have to also consider the level of interest rates.
Yes.
And you especially, you looked at the famous Shiller-Cape ratio,
yes,
which values stocks based on trailing 10 years earnings,
yes,
rather than just 1 year's forward or backwards. So tell us how you're thinking about the equity market now, particularly with these really elevated Shiller-Cape valuations, as they're called,
yes,
juxtaposed to this idea that rates are going to be rock bottom going forward longer than we perhaps thought at,
yes,
the beginning of the year.
Well, thanks, Fett. I am indeed a very long-term, very long-suffering supporter of the Shiller-Cape. I do actually think it makes a lot of sense, even though it has suggested that markets are very expensive for a very long time, even as the markets have continued to rise. Now, what is important, I don't think anybody has ever said about anything that it is a silver bullet. Plenty of people make the point correctly that the Cape isn't a silver bullet. Shiller himself, on his website, presents his calculation for Cape along with his measure of long-term interest rates, which these days is a simple 10-year treasury yield, and he does some very clever historical numbers to come up with long-term interest rates that cohered in 1870. He's got continuous data series for both ever since then. What I think is important about the Cape is that many people have said we can ignore it, and their argument for saying they can ignore it is that there was this epic earnings recession in 2007, 2008, 2009, which means that the denominator, the earnings, is artificially reduced, meaning that the Cape looks artificially high.
So, sorry, John, what's brought us back to this idea that this is now a really good measure to consider? What's brought the renaissance now?
I think, well, the renaissance in my mind, I'm trying to spark a renaissance.
John created the renaissance.
Yes, exactly.
Or as we say in Philadelphia, renaissance.
Renaissance,
oh,
yes.
Oh, sorry.
The argument, the Australian English upbringings, they have terrible effects on your pronunciation. Basically, the big criticism has been that the 10 years of earnings that you are comparing prices to include earnings from the great earnings recession that accompanied the Lehman crisis, the Great Recession.
Right.
And therefore, the argument was that once those numbers started to drop out of the 10-year number, you would see the Cape begin to reduce because the earnings rose a lot, for no good reason other than that those numbers were dropping
out
from 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Now, we are now just past the point, we've just passed the 10th anniversary of the bottom of that earnings recession. So all the earnings as we went from top to bottom have now dropped out of the calculation. And lo and behold, the Cape is actually higher than it was at the 10th anniversary of the peak before the recession started. Also, quite remarkably, it has actually risen more over that time than the prospective PE has. So the idea that this would show itself to be a pointless indicator that was obviously not relevant has actually been disproved. Now, I don't think that should be too surprising if you stop to think about it, because earnings were artificially inflated by artificially cheap credit before,
right,
the crash. Everybody knows about kitchen sinking by companies. They were artificially low at the bottom, and then the recovery again involved artificially manipulating accruals accounting to make them look good. Over 10 years, it's actually quite difficult to manipulate accruals accounting. You really got to commit pretty serious fraud for the 10-year number not to be a fairly good number. And over 10 years, basically, the trend has been remarkably steady. There was the biggest blip we've had since the war for the earnings recession. But beyond that, the trend has continued absolutely in force. That's what people could tell when they were making their numbers. Does that mean that the stock market should not be this high? No, because interest rates, as Schiller himself and everybody else acknowledges, are very important to the valuation you put on stocks. Does it mean, however, that without that, if interest rates did what everybody was expecting until a few months ago and rise, plainly the CAPE is a clear indicator that stocks have a long way to fall should rates rise. We are utterly dependent at this point, particularly with anxiety about where earnings are going in the future. We are utterly dependent on low interest rates.
And, you know, you make a great point there in that we came into this year, everyone expecting higher rates all year, higher rates from the Fed, the knock-on effect of higher treasury rates. Emily, is everyone assuming now that it's lower forever now? You know, you talk to a lot of fixed income bond market people. Is there a consensus towards that way? And is there a danger that, whoops, the consensus might be wrong again?
Yeah, it's really hard to see at this point anyone who actually thinks that a hike is coming anytime, really, for as far as the eye can see. I mean, it seems like the debate we're now having, which is actually different to what we had yesterday, is whether or not we get a 50 basis point or a 25 basis point cut, rather than whether the Fed will actually cut rates at all in July. So it seems as if, you know, market expectations are ramping back up again. We've definitely got that 50 basis points back on the table. It's just a matter of whether or not the Fed takes that kind of action.
And I guess in a way, the rates outlook goes hand in hand with the earnings outlook, which is, Valdana's pretty dismal right now, along with some of the softer economic data we've seen. So you've done a lot of reporting on what we can expect for the upcoming earnings season. I've talked to a lot of investors, looked at the data. What are you expecting, basically, and how are investors sort of bracing for this earnings season?
Yeah, well, like you mentioned, there is just so much uncertainty out there, which has been around for all year, basically, when it comes to trade and higher dollar and higher input costs and all those things. But expectations for the second quarter are -2%, -3% in terms of earnings, and flat for the third quarter, and then we're supposed to see a pickup again later in the year in the fourth quarter. But out of all the companies that have been revising guidance, either higher or lower, 80% are actually revising lower. And we had Gina Martin Adams of Bloomberg Intelligence, who I know has been on the show before. She said 2Q expectations, companies are cutting them to the bone. And when it comes to forecasts, they might not actually be cutting enough.
So how much, Valdana, is the actual macro backdrop factoring into this? I mean, are trade concerns the things that people are citing when they're talking about lower expectations? Does Fed policy play into kind of any hopes there of improvement? Or?
Yeah, well, we'll see what happens now that we have a bit more clarity from what we can expect from the Fed. But certainly trade has played a part in this. We've seen a lot of reports on companies that have been citing trade. We had BASF earlier in the week saying it's due to trade that we have to cut our profit forecasts by 30%. So it really does seem to be making its way into what companies are saying.
Yeah, that BASF was a lot bigger cut than I think people were expecting.
Yeah.
John, what do you think? Is this a risky setup that we're in right now going into this earnings season? Or I wonder if it, with rates so low, it'll be the type of situation where you might see some rotation in and out of different sectors and companies that are at risk to trade, but not really a full-on abandonment of the stock market as a whole.
It's difficult to see how. I mean, cards on the table. I've been a long-term bear for quite a while. I find the current valuations very hard to justify. In the short term, it's difficult to see how anything too bad can happen to the stock market. I think the likelihood that companies that manage to play the earnings management game well and deliver a beat, in inverted commas, gets rewarded with much of a pop in the share price that day, that's pretty low. And I suspect anybody with a truly bad surprise is really going to get punished. That's been a fact pattern we've seen in quite a number of earnings seasons over the last year or two. But while we have a situation where it looks as though the Fed is heading lower and people are still merrily discounting 4 or 5 rate cuts between now and the end of next year, which is what they are, and while the ECB appears to be locked down and obviously the poor old Bank of England has to contend with the prospect of a no-deal Brexit and really can't do anything hawkish whether it wants to or not, while we're in that kind of locked, forced, dovish stance, it's difficult to see how we can get a major market break. We've had major market breaks. Well, we had 2 major market breaks last year, both of which, one of which was prompted by a very sharp rise in the bond market, and one was prompted by a very sharp rise in perceptions of Fed hawkishness. I doubt that is what we need in this day and age to get a market break, and at the moment that looks unlikely.
So does this put the Tina point front and center then, that we're not really getting anywhere away from the US at this point? Does anything globally in terms of emerging markets start to look more attractive at that point? Or,
well, in general, if you look back to 2017, which was one of the most least volatile, calmest years, if you go by sharp ratios, it was possibly the best year for world stock markets ever because it was so calm on the way upwards. That was a year when the US did actually lose to the rest of the world, and emerging markets did somewhat better than developed. And logically, you would expect something similar to that again. I suppose the one wild card there is also trade. If what's bad for China on trade will also be bad for a lot of the emerging world. But in essence, if we are looking at a weakening dollar and lower US rates, that relieves pressure on some very cheap emerging markets.
Interesting. They might actually be the outperformer in this environment.
Logically, they really ought to be.
Right, right.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Now, you mentioned, John, being a long-term bear. Looking at the fund flows this year, I don't think you're alone. I mean, there's been this exodus of cash from equity funds, a massive inpouring into fixed income funds. Vildana, you talk to a lot of investors every day. I mean, do you get sort of a consensus? Are people leaning towards the bearish side, even though we keep seeing these new highs? Or, you know, what are the people you talk to really focusing on right now?
Yeah, they certainly are. If you look at all of the strategists that Bloomberg tracks, the majority of them are saying that the S&P will end the year at a lower point than where we are now. And we did see the S&P cross the 3,000 mark for the very first time this week. And it's, again, going back to actually a few factors. One, the uncertainty and trade is what a lot of people are citing. So even after we had the trade truce from the G20 meeting, we had strategists at RBC coming out and saying, this doesn't really change the game for us. We're reiterating our S&P target of 2950, similarly at a few other shops. And then the other part of it is that we're up 20% for the year. Halfway through the year, we're up 20%. That's pretty good. So it's sort of a conundrum where investors are thinking about, well, what happens next? What happens for the next 6 months, considering that we've been up so much?
I think a lot of that is the base effect that we had a screeching correction that came to its finale on Christmas Eve. So we're still not much above the peak from October.
Right.
It's just an example of the will-o'-the-wisp that if you can tactically time market moves like this, you would be very, very rich indeed. but if you're on a more realistic way, where we're not just looking at the calendar, this is an unusual point where the calendar year really makes the returns, you know, really flatters the returns.
And right. We're flat for the past 18 months.
Yeah.
Right. Ever since that melt up at the beginning of 2018, we're not much higher than that. So I guess a correction can occur over time as well as price, more or less.
I'm thinking about that comment that you made about conundrum, though, Viltana. It does raise sort of concerns about, you know, where do we start to get worried about where asset prices are headed, right? Right. But I guess that's something in the debt markets that people are thinking about all the time, financial stability being a part of the Fed's mandate too.
I have to mention one of the candidates I considered for my maddest thing I saw in the market this week is that there is such a thing in Europe now as a negative yielding, high yielding bond, which does appear to me to suggest that things have gone a little blurry.
I think you just stole Emily's thunder.
I hate to say this, I'm crestfallen now because I worked so hard to think of
spoiler alert.
I've got a few more I can lend you later on.
But
that would be one of the that would be one sign that perhaps. The rate story has been taken a tad too far,
all right,
if you ask me, with British understatement.
I think clearly everyone is itching to get to that craziest thing they saw this week. And in fact, Vildana, my sources tell me you're very much a connoisseur of crazy things you've seen in markets. Okay. But first, we have to talk about the Winklevoss, because I'm fascinated with these two guys. You know, obviously, they won a settlement against Mark Zuckerberg years ago for their role in basically creating Facebook. Then they went on to become sort of the biggest cheerleaders for Bitcoin out there. They're trying to create a Bitcoin ETF. What are they up to now? What's the latest in sort of the Winklevoss soap opera after your meeting with them?
That's a good way to put it, soap opera. I met them earlier this week, and so, again, this is another interesting thing that's happening where a lot of people are saying, well, Zuckerberg came in and sort of bested them at Facebook. They were early Bitcoin backers. In fact, it's been reported that they own about 1% of all the Bitcoins that are out there.
Wow.
Which is really a huge sum by today's dollars. But then we had Facebook come out and with its own cryptocurrency, Libra project. And given how many users Facebook has and just how much hype there's been around Facebook's Libra project, a lot of people are asking, well, is Zuckerberg sort of swooping in again and taking the spotlight, even though you guys have been around for in the crypto sphere for a much longer time?
Yeah. You think there's any credence to that? I mean, obviously, Zuckerberg might have completely unrelated motivations to get into crypto, but I love the conspiracy theory element of it. Do you think the tensions between those three are so bad that Zuckerberg might be looking for revenge?
They spoke on a panel in New York earlier this week, and the moderator asked them, what would you say to Zuckerberg if you were to see him at a party? And they said, we'd say, welcome to the party. What took you so long to get here? So,
and did they have any update on the ETF? Is that's still in limbo, I guess?
It is in limbo for a few of the other companies that have been trying to issue one. I think we're supposed to be hearing from the SEC soon again for those, but not for theirs. Theirs was rejected a little while ago.
Right. That was officially rejected.
Think so, yeah.
I am thinking this sounds almost like the Hunt brothers in silver. Imagine somebody cornering 1% of all the available gold or silver on the planet. And there are people who regard Bitcoin as a similar kind of resource. That's quite something.
I think Mr. T did that in the 80s.
Around his neck.
The twins were the first Bitcoin billionaires, or reportedly one of the first Bitcoin billionaires, which is what's gained them some more fame again recently with Bitcoin's renaissance. Renaissance.
There we go with Renaissance. John, do you follow the crypto world at all? I mean, does this is this another world compared with what we grew up trying to think of investment as?
I have a line on this. My own opinion on this is I'm afraid to say somewhat close to consensus, which is that blockchain per se might be a bit overhyped, but there is plainly something there. The same way as the laser and the internet came out, and at first everybody could see they were wonderful but weren't quite sure how they were going to use them. Similarly, blockchain and the concept of cryptocurrencies will have great use, particularly once they've worked out ways not to use quite so much computing power and electricity to operate them. Bitcoin per se, and particularly all the Me Too digital currencies, seem very alarmingly to me like a classic speculative bubble. Okay, they've had several speculative bubbles. If you look at Bitcoin on a log scale, it's quite startling.
Right.
I still don't really see how it can function as a currency while its value is so variable.
Yeah.
It's just it just cannot be this store of value, this speculative mine, if it's also going to try to be a means of exchange. And those are the critical things a currency can do. If it achieves one, it fails the other at this point.
Right. I would go out on a limb, Emily, and say Bitcoin's the craziest thing I've ever seen in my career, possibly.
Oh, yeah.
And we had Powell getting questions about Libra during week's testimony.
I missed that. What did he answer?
Well, he said that we really need to be cautious. It can't be a sprint forward, and that there's a lot of concerns, money laundering, theft.
He's sounding a little less hip than Carney was when people started talking about Bitcoin a while ago. It sounds like the Bank of England governor was kind of out there and trying to show his cred fairly early on. But
well, those Brits are always hipper than us. I mean, we've gotten used to that.
He's Canadian, but Canadians are much hipper than Americans.
Carney, he's Canadian.
Yes.
Anyway, to go from the craziest thing I've ever seen in my career, let's go to the craziest thing we've seen this week. And I have to warn you three, there's some tough competition from Twitter. We've asked Twitter to weigh in on the craziest thing they've seen this week. And let me just say, Twitter sees some crazy stuff, as we all know. I'm going to quote someone named Twiggy Sunday on Twitter. I'm assuming that's a real name. Twiggy Sunday, got to be, right? And he's saying the craziest thing he's ever seen, and he refers to a tweet by at Gregor Hunter, who points out, John, I think you'll like this one. The Argentinian yield curve has inverted, but not just any curve. It's the 9-year, 98-year yield curve in the Argentinian debt market. Emily, classically, the yield curve inversion, 3-month, 5-year, 3-month, 10-year foreshadows a recession. What does this foreshadow? Like an alien invasion?
For Argentina? I mean, it's a little hard to call it for Argentina, really, right? They've been so stable for so long. I think basically an alien invasion is probably the best way to put that. Hopefully not too soon.
I think it's implying that the pampases will still be there and the herds of cattle will be still there, be there 98 years from now. But Lord alone knows what's going to happen in the next few. Maybe that. Off the top of my head, I've never ever thought of the dynamics of a 9 versus 98-year curve before. So,
all right. Well, John, no pressure, but can you top Twiggy Sunday with the maddest thing you've seen in markets?
Two from Europe, both intimately linked to politics. One is Greece elected a new prime minister this weekend. The third Greek prime minister this century who is the son of a previous Greek prime minister. The country that gave the whole world the concept of democracy seems to be quite keen on heredity when it comes to choosing their prime ministers. Anyway, in response to that, the yields on 10-year Greek bonds briefly dropped below the yields on 10-year treasuries.
That is pretty amazing.
That's pretty amazing. And then just because I feel like...
everybody, and Emily, correct me if I'm wrong, everyone will lecture that, well, you can't compare yields on bonds in different currencies. Yeah. You have to look at the swap outs.
Yeah,
I know.
I just
felt the need to be that guy. Someone had to.
Thank you for saying it. Does that mean John doesn't win?
A long, cruel history at school where you've been that guy who makes that point.
Vildana's a little competitive with the craziest
really
thing.
I can tell
you can see it in her eyes.
Now, the other point, which I think is not crazy in one level, but is utterly nuts at another level, is if you look at the predict it market, the chances, if you want to get a Boris Johnson to be UK prime minister by the end of next month future, you will have to pay 99 cents on the dollar. It is rating him as a 99% certain to be the next prime minister of Britain. I actually think the prediction market is roughly accurate in its odds. I find the fact that there is a 99% chance that Boris Johnson will shortly be my prime minister is the craziest thing I have seen in markets in a long time.
Are you applying for naturalization now?
So that I can come somewhere with a really sensible choice of president. with somebody who has a really good haircut rather than Boris's in charge.
There is no alternative.
Certainly the craziest hair we've seen in markets.
I think
weekend.
It probably means we all have to emigrate to New Zealand if we're going to go with prime ministers who have a certain degree of cachet. But anyway.
All right, Emily, unfortunately, John front ran your craziest thing. You were looking at negative yielding corporate debt now,
well,
right?
Well, yeah. So I actually got some figures on this. Thanks, John. I was going to dig into it right now.
Yeah.
But we now have, I can actually put the details around his beautifully pitched point, which was we went from zero to 14 high yield European bonds and now traveling like below zero in terms of yield, which is pretty horrific in many ways.
So people will pay a high yield issuer to look after their money for them.
Yes,
for
indeed.
Is it really quote unquote high yield when it's below zero? We need a new name for this stuff.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll give you mine because I think Vildana is going to really bring it. I'm going to save her for last. I think she's.
That's a lot of pressure.
I think she's going to bring it with the crazy thing. Even though I started off saying there's no alternative, I'm going to once again look into the alternative asset markets for my craziest thing. So the baseball gloves used to record the final out in Game 7 of the Chicago Cubs 2016 World Series, they're up for auction. John, without looking at my notes here, what would you guess the bottom rung price is in that auction for the two gloves used to record the final out in the 2016 World Series?
I don't remember what there was. So this was from the pitcher to first, or was this, are these infield gloves or are they nice big outfield gloves?
Third baseman. I like how it depends on what gloves they are for.
Yeah.
John would clearly pay more for a catcher's mitt.
Well, if it's a catcher's mitt, you know, obviously that's got more of a premium. Yeah.
It was the throw from third baseman Chris Bryant. Fielded the ball to Anthony Rizzo on first base. Yeah.
Okay, so they're both people we've heard of, quite famous.
I don't know. Does that mean it's a left and right glove? So you could wear them as a pair, I guess.
Yes, I guess that's true. You'd look a little ridiculous. Baseball glove on each
what
hand.
What does John get for getting this right, by the way? This is quite intense.
I would start maybe 10 grand each.
$250,000 is the minimum bid.
Wow.
For so $125,000 for each glove.
How does that compare with Steve Bartman's Walkman?
That's a good question.
The previous most important item in Cubs history. But anyway, carry on. Right.
So what's that? So that's 10 Bitcoin each?
It sounds cheap in Bitcoin, actually. Yeah. That's not bad. Good point. All right, Vildana, show us up here. I know you've got something good for us. What's the craziest thing you saw in markets this week?
The first thing I thought was so strange that I was certain one of you would also find it, so I found a second thing as well.
A backup? You did not mess around with this.
I didn't, because I know you crowned a winner last week, so I'm aiming for that this week.
All right.
We actually had some reports that Taco Bell has a shortage of 10-inch tortillas.
Oh, my gosh.
Which are used in burritos, quesadillas, in just about everything, and a lot of their breakfast items as well. And Bank of America came out with a note saying, look at this. Taco Bell is suffering with a tortilla shortage. I forget what some people called it on Twitter. Tortilla apocalypse. Yeah. But they raised their price target on Yum Brands, which owns the Taco Bell brand.
Because of the shortage of tortillas?
In spite of it.
Yeah. The biggest Mexican tortilla manufacturer is called Gruma.
Right.
They mentioned...
That's who you should be long them, right?
That sounds like that's a very interesting investment.
But couldn't they just have trimmed a 12-inch tortilla?
Or used a 6-inch and a 4-inch tortilla?
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right. That's pretty good, Vildana.
I have one more.
You got one more.
Yeah.
Right. You're going for gold and silver.
I am, yes. Now, in select cities, in about 40 cities, you can actually request that your Uber driver stay silent during your ride, and you have to pay about 20 to 40% more per ride.
Worth it.
Totally. I think it's totally worth it.
Worth it.
I don't go to Taco Bell, but this is something I would definitely...
Plenty of good journalists would be deprived of stories.
Yeah.
Guys, I hate to say it. I think Vildana tied herself for first place with this.
Second.
First, yeah. Yeah.
First.
We're all distant third on that. But we'll have to get you back for some more crazy market observations in the future. Those were really good. But I think that's our time for this week. Emily, thank you for filling Sarah's shoes.
Thanks for having me on.
And Sarah will be back next week. I'll actually be off, but Luke Kawa from the Cross Asset team will be filling in for me. So I'm sure his ratings will be much higher. Viltana, John, thanks so much for joining us this week. We hope you come back.
Thank you.
Thanks.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, website, and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. You can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Reganonymous. Sarah Ponczak is at Sarah Ponczak. Emily Barrett is at Not That ECB. Vildana Heirich is at Vildana Heirich. And John Authors is at John Authors. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Voorhees. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. Hope we see you next time.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.